This is a crusade. This is a holy war against the deep state.
Where are the dictators? Where are the strong men?
Donald Trump is our instrument for retribution.
I'm going to fight for Christians. I'm going to fight for white people.
They have the Great Reset. We have the Great Awakening.
And why shouldn't I root for Russia?
Because I am.
I want to see these people go through misery because of their grooming against our children.
After the assailant entered the home asking, "Where's Nancy? Where's Nancy?" Those are the very same words used by the mob when they stormed the United States Capitol.
I did nothing wrong.
Welcome to the Did Nothing Wrong podcast, where we cut through the noise and help you make sense of the chaotic information space around us. I'm Griff Somke. Evan McLaren was the executive director of the National Policy Institute, Richard Spencer's white nationalist think tank, until he resigned in 2018. On this episode of the Did Nothing Wrong podcast, he joins me to discuss how he got involved with white nationalism, what made him leave, and what he'd say to someone in the position he was in. Stick around. Evan, welcome to Did Nothing Wrong. Thanks for coming on.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
So how does a guy get involved with white nationalists anyway?
I had a weird route to white nationalism. I mean, I think interesting or not that you can decide that, but the part that is personal to me has more to do with before I hit libertarianism.
Okay.
Once I hit libertarianism, it's kind of that libertarianism to fascism pipeline.
Yeah, that's a common one.
Yeah, it's kind of just traveling that route the same way a lot of people did.
Right.
But prior to that, I mean, I went to public schools in Central PA until I was a sophomore. And then I went to the Lawrenceville School in New Jersey. I was playing ice hockey at the time.
Okay.
And it was kind of like, you know, am I good enough to play at a higher level? You know, I'm at like 14, 15, 16 years old at this point. You know, what am I doing with a sport? And prep school hockey represented a jump up.
Right.
And so they offered me a little money to go play at Lawrenceville.
Okay.
But Lawrenceville is, I mean, it's possibly the most expensive prep school or private school in the world.
Right.
So it represented a huge shift, like socially and sociologically for me. I'm just kind of a middle-class kid, and all of a sudden I'm in school with people who are talking a completely different language, leading a completely different life. And I remember being really insecure about not understanding politics or political dialogue. Suddenly I was around some people who like were really had some very, they were very certain about their politics. And I was just like, I don't even know what liberal or conservative means. Like, I don't know what any of this means. So I remember reading the New York Times editorial page every day, trying to figure out what was going on.
Right.
And still not really having a clue, but like kind of searching from that point onward. And I wanted to have something to say. You know, something that I knew to be right or that I was convinced about.
Right.
And it sounds kind of backwards, but in college, later on, I remember the first thing I felt really certain about, like, I just knew how I felt about it right away, was the invasion of Iraq in 2003.
Right.
I was like, who is taking this seriously? This is so just transparently dumb, and the whole rationale is dumb. But I remember being sort of at a superficial level. I remember being kind of disillusioned with a lot of liberals or left-wingers that I talked to. Because they were like, you know, yeah, Bush was so dumb. Like, it was all about Bush. And I'm like, yeah, he is. But, like, there has to be a bigger reason why we got into something so big. It can't just be this dumb guy
right.
got us into it. There has to be a bigger systemic failure.
Yeah.
And so I was just looking around for people who were going to talk to me about that. Give me like an overarching theory for this whole thing. And unfortunately, the people who got to me were like Ron Paul libertarians, basically.
Okay.
Started reading lewrockwell.com. And so the whole narrative there is, okay, yeah, on the surface, it's the GOP. It's conservatives. But really, if you zoom out, it's liberals. We're living in leftism. We're living in liberalism. And it's leftists and liberals who have dismantled the constitutional Republican order. We don't declare wars anymore. It's all these police actions. The executive does it. And that's a left-wing project. We're spreading rights. You know, we're right. doing this French Revolution thing where we spread rights abroad and suddenly we have to invade all these countries all over the world. And I'm just like, yeah, yeah. So that was my buy-in. And then all of a sudden I'm like, try to wrap my head around everything these libertarians are trying to say. So I'm reading Austrian economic theory, and I'm going into Murray Rothbard. And from that point, it was, like I said earlier, a libertarian to fascist pipeline, and just taking it stepwise from there.
Right, right. Because the folks over at, like, lourockwell.com, they basically almost believe, like, the GOP is controlled opposition, if I remember right.
Yeah, pretty much.
They kind of see it like this is not a real serious political party. They just sort of exist to prop up the liberals and help them achieve their agenda.
Yeah, that's what I was, if you had talked to me at that time, that's what I would have been saying.
Right.
And I think different people at lourockwell.com, I haven't read it in ages, but different people there have different spins on it. Eventually, I had a moment, I mean, a long moment, where I took libertarian economics pretty seriously. But, you know, I was reading stuff daily at lourockwell.com, and the stuff just started to sound dumb from an economic perspective, where it was like, you know, articles, you could get an article published if you were just like, you know, I talked to my daughter this morning, and she was like, Daddy, I don't get, you know, why are there taxes? So that doesn't make any sense. It's like, she gets it, like 800 words about how even the toddler understands that taxation is theft.
Oh, God.
And I'm like, this sounds dumb. But Paul Gottfried was also writing articles there.
Okay.
And Paul Gottfried was more appealing to me because his stuff is what it is, but it's not that dumb. He is at least much more informed in terms of history. He's a much smarter guy. And so that appealed to me because he was getting into, like, particulars. He was getting into historical arguments to make his case.
Right.
And that was at least more interesting to me. And although he was, like, more diplomatic, he was diplomatic enough that he wasn't going to bring out his disagreements with libertarianism at lourockwell.com. But I could tell, like, okay, this guy's not a libertarian. Like, what's going on here?
Right.
And, you know, sort of started to piece together these arguments, like, the tension that existed between, like, paleoconservatives and libertarianism.
Right.
And that was one of the things that started moving me along this pipeline towards what eventually became the alt-right.
Right.
So I went, you know, Paul Gottfried taught at Elizabethtown College, which is, like, you know, 20 miles from where I grew up. So I went and introduced myself to him.
Okay.
One day while I was on break, or summer break or something. And he invited me to, he was like, first of all, he was like, I'm not a libertarian. I want you to know that. Because I was like, yeah, I write your stuff at lourockwell.com. And he's like, well, I'm not a libertarian. Let's make that clear. I'm like, okay. And but the next thing he said was, he was like, oh, I am starting a new group. So why don't you come join us? We're having our first meeting, whenever it was. This would have been 2007-ish, maybe.
Okay.
And that group was what eventually became the H.L. Mencken Club.
Ah, okay.
So at that first meeting, there was Jared Taylor, James O'Keefe was at that meeting, Kevin Dean was at that meeting, Paul Gottfried, obviously, right. Jeff Frazee, who worked on Ron Paul's campaign for a while. And I didn't know who any of these people were. I was still very new and kind of naive. I remember being impressed with Jared Taylor. You know, just hearing him speak, nothing about race or anything came up. I didn't know what he was about, but I went home and looked him up afterwards and kind of was like, oh, okay. And I maybe had gotten the sense before that, like, you know, the stuff that I was reading and engaging in was leading towards a darker place. But nonetheless, I was curious. I was interested. And I think that moment was a very clear moment where I kind of felt that I had bought in.
Right.
And maybe I didn't know what I had bought into fully, but I had bought the ticket. I was going to take the ride. And I was kind of fascinated with my own process of radicalization. So I didn't know immediately, like, how I felt about the race and IQ and everything that Jared Taylor was bringing to the table. But I kind of felt like, I don't know how I feel about it. I have to go read. I have to go figure it out.
Right. Because this was probably all very new for somebody to say some of this stuff out loud.
Yeah. I mean, once you know, this libertarian to fascist pipeline, I mean, once you, like he said earlier, once you buy into this rubric where the GOP and conservatism are controlled opposition, and everything they say is kind of BS, and this is watered down leftism.
Right.
Now, I mean, the person presenting that, they can then turn and say, well, I'm not racist, or they can have their own kind of, you know, a la carte politics.
Right.
Once that kind of domino is set up, I feel like it's just waiting to be knocked down by someone coming along and saying, you know, actually, you know, Jim Crow was essentially right. Actually, segregation is right. Actually, colonialism and the white man ruling over non-white peoples, you know, actually that's right. And the people who dismantled that, because remember, those are the, you know, closet leftists.
Right.
Those are all the Republicans and Democrats that we already agreed that we despise. And so whatever they did is bad, bad. So I was kind of set up to buy into that stuff. But after that, I became, you know, became more and more networked. Started writing for some of these publications and just kind of kept taking it from there.
Were you writing under your real name or did you have a pen name?
For the most part, I was writing under my real name. I mean, when I joined MPI, it was kind of, it was one of these things where there was like one guy at the SPLC who had noticed me before, like tweeting under my real name.
Right.
But it was one of the things that was noted. It's like kind of weird how I managed to fly under the radar a little bit, even though I was mostly writing under my own name. But when I wrote a Takis magazine and maybe one or two other pieces here or there for LouRockwell.com and some other blogs and stuff. But yeah, it was under my own name from what I remember.
I'm always curious because one of the people we had on the podcast is a woman named Katie McHugh.
Yeah.
Who used to be a Breitbart editor. She was also with the Daily Caller for a long time. And one of the things that she said was that half of the interns in Washington on various, you know, GOP campaigns, right, for sites like Takis and Daily Caller and you know, VDare, even under assumed names.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, VDare is fighting that really hard in court right now. They don't want to talk about who's actually writing under what names for their website because it would probably be pretty scandalous if they did. So,
yeah, definitely.
So, were you ever associated with any other white nationalist groups besides the NPI?
Well, there was the H.L. Mencken Club, not directly white nationalist. I belonged to Identity Europa when that was a thing.
Okay.
And National Policy Institute wrote for Talkings Magazine. I think that's about it for white nationalist groups.
What made you end things with Identity Europa? Why did you walk away from that?
So leading up to Charlottesville, you know, the feeling was very high on the alt-right.
Right.
The feeling was very cooperative. There was not a scarcity mentality at all.
Right, right.
Attention for anyone was good for everybody.
Right.
So, although I was working for the National Policy Institute, there was no problem that I was also still a member of Identity Europa.
Right, right.
Even though I didn't have any leadership responsibilities with them at that point. After Charlottesville, when that all went really bad, that mentality just stopped and the knives were out. People were blaming each other. People were forming tighter and tighter circles. Cooperative relationships were falling apart. And Eli Mosley, Elliot Klein, I guess was his real name, who was kind of our guy running Identity Europa. He was sort of just a puppet for Richard Spencer. He was pushed out and Nathan D'Amico and Patrick Casey took over.
Right. I remember that.
And so that split was, what precipitated me either leaving or being kicked out of Identity Europa. I forget exactly how it happened.
Right. Because that was about when I started, you know, really figuring out what was going on. I remember watching that thing kind of come together in early 2017 and realizing that this was scary because there are a lot of these people and they're what you said about no sense of a scarcity mentality and that everybody was actually working together. And that, I think, was sort of the terrifying part, at least for somebody like me, because I had at that point distilled the idea that this stuff was basically a cross between Alexander Dugin and Sam Francis on some level.
Yeah.
And was kind of like, oh boy, there's a lot of people that are buying into some really, really bad ideas. Talked to a few of them and was convinced that this was going to be kind of a problem. And then Charlottesville hit. And like you said, things were so bad after that. Everybody was blaming each other. There were a lot of finger pointing and, you know, recriminations. And it seems like on some level, that feeling of we're all in this together and we can turn this into a bigger movement sort of shattered.
Yeah. Now, what's scary is that I think it's reconstituted itself in a different way.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely agreed.
But in a much more widespread way. Like, I think that the guys that you would run into if you went to some of these events in 2017 would be the kind of guys who were like really, really up on, you know, Harold Covington.
Yeah.
They would be really well read and they would be like their pointy implement of white nationalism and white supremacy would be very, very sharp.
Right.
It's a little bit more blunt now, but it is much bigger. It seems to me to be spread much more widely, and you know, many, many more people on the right and in conservatism and in the GOP are bought in. And so it's potentially a lot scarier now even.
Oh yeah. The younger generation of like GOP staffers is coming up, and they are almost every single one of them's got a Groyper account. Prove me wrong.
When I say this, it is going to sound like exactly what a lot of conservatives say. This is the unfair BS that I turn off, but the younger generation of conservatives are Nazis, essentially.
Yeah, and this is not something I think that is terribly controversial in 2024.
No.
They've been proving it since they've been on the scene. Look at like the influence a guy like Nick Fuentes has on so many people and so many things that it's just, okay, this is terrifying. This is where they're getting their ideas. This is where, you know, this guy's getting mainstream coverage. He's going on mainstream podcasts. He's talking about the Jewish question, and it's a little terrifying, really. It really makes one think that these ideas are getting out there in a level that they haven't necessarily gotten out there before.
Yeah.
Because even like in the libertarian days, they weren't going to come out and say it right out, even if that's what they meant.
Yeah.
It really make you, you know, get with the program before they were willing to tell you some of that kind of stuff, and that's how they felt about it. But like a guy like Fuentes, nah, he's just on the stream every day.
Yeah. Yeah, it's bad. It would be bad enough if it was just the political and racial content.
Right.
But there is also a very profound unseriousness and lack of maturity that also comes with it.
Yeah.
And it kind of arises from this mentality that there's a lack of ethics, there's a lack of morality. It is purely based on friend-enemy distinctions. And so if you're a leftist, nothing you say has any value.
Right.
Nothing that comes out of your mouth has any factual worth. We don't have to take seriously any of your arguments. We can just laugh at you.
Mm-hmm.
There is a true lack of humanity there. And so, you know, half the time they can be joking and trolling. And if someone gets offended, that's great. That's the fun and the joy of it.
Oh, yes.
But then, you know, the purpose of the humor is to begin to create that buy-in. Like, okay, we're joking about it, but also now we're not joking about it. Like we do want to gas the Jews. We do want to do all of these things that we're kidding about.
It's all a joke, bro, until it isn't.
Oh, yeah.
And they're using, they'll tell you this. We've done plenty of stuff on Fuentes, and he'll tell you this straight up. You know, I use subversive humor to get my point across because the only way I can do this is as a joke, but I really believe this stuff. No, I don't. I'm kidding. Aha. Or maybe I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, the goal is to confuse whoever's listening and get them to the point where they aren't sure. But the people that he wants to hear it, hear it.
I think we're all a little bit bipolar. I mean, I try to be a good citizen and a good person socially, like not toxic socially.
Right.
A good person to be around. Now, you catch me on a bad day, you cut me off in traffic, like I might get upset. But, you know, those are the two kind of poles that my personality swings between. For these people, the more they buy into it, it gets replaced by those two poles. The humanity is gone.
Yeah.
And all that's left is laughing about anti-Semitism and, you know, conquering the world for the white man, or actually seriously doing it. And there's not much left, unfortunately.
Yeah. So what made you change your mind about all of this? How did you come to the realization that this was a load of shit and you got out?
Yeah. I was always at least questioning in a sense, even earlier on.
Right.
And not always questioning necessarily the arguments themselves, although, you know, I was doing that, but coming to the wrong conclusions. But I know two things were kind of on my mind. I mean, the place of this entire thing in the world, like, how do I exist socially and as a person while also being a white nationalist? I mean, there are some white nationalists with really dark backgrounds, very criminal backgrounds.
Oh, yeah.
You could, even if they weren't connected to white nationalism, you could tell they were just completely out of sorts with society. And that was not for me. I mean, the kind of sad thing about my case is that I can talk about how, you know, kind of insecurities and dislocations in one's personal and social life can lead them towards white nationalism.
Right.
And you can turn that back to me and say, okay, what was going on with you? Well, nothing really. I was just kind of weak. You know, I had an ordinarily difficult social life, which is to say I didn't really have that difficult a social life at all. a little bit insecure about, dating and relationships, a little bit insecure about, where I was going to land in terms of career. And I kind of look at myself at that time and it's like, suck it up. Like, white nationalism is not an answer to these things. But regardless, I didn't hate society so much.
Right.
That I wanted to just blow it up with dynamite. So it was always a question for me, like, okay, like, white people, the white race is in crisis, but I don't want to not have a social existence here.
Right, right.
So I was always asking questions about that and never really getting fully satisfactory answers. And the other thing was, like, there was so much energy and activity and conviction among all these people. I just thought to myself, this notion from, like, Hillary Clinton that there's a vast right-wing conspiracy, someone has to be running this thing. Like, somebody has to have a game plan.
Right.
Someone has to know where this all is going. You can't tell me I'm out here writing under my own name, setting my career and my life on fire, but no one really has a clue where this is going. So even though I really bought in hard once, like, I kind of reached a depressive stage and found my way out a little bit, but not really. Like, I hadn't lost any of the convictions. I just wasn't active for a period of time until the Trump campaign got going. Richard Spencer started getting more attention. And to me, that felt real. That felt substantial. I was like, okay, this thing, there is some seriousness here. This is going someplace. And I can come back and kind of, like, really, like, push all my chips in.
Okay.
Once I did that, and once I had many more experiences with people who were coming off of the internet, and I'm getting to encounter more and more people in person, and especially after Charlottesville, I mean, that was a big event where things began to go downhill. It dawned on me, like, oh yeah, no one is leading this. Like, Right. There are definitely people with more influence and more clout who can produce talking points that will be adopted, but there's no one who has, like, a clear plan. There's no one who's directing this thing.
So you got to the man behind the curtain, and there just kind of wasn't one, really.
Yeah, there wasn't one. And then, I got to know, I had written for Talkies magazine when Richard Spencer was the editor.
Okay.
And Richard Spencer is just kind of I did not appreciate, like, I sensed it. And most of our correspondence for a lot of years was by email, right. Me sending in blogs or articles. And on the one hand, the guy seems intelligent. He's very charismatic. On the other hand, like, can he possibly be as narcissistic and checked out as he seems?
Well,
I gave him the benefit of the doubt for a long time, but eventually I realized that's it. Like, what you see is what you get. He is as narcissistic as he seems. Like, I saw a lot more of him from the inside. So from the point of Charlottesville, and for example, when the cooperation within Identity Europa began to fall apart, and I started to have more and more just broken down relationships within the alt-right.
Right.
And seeing more and more people who I just couldn't relate to them or couldn't sustain a relationship with them. Because I think that even though I did eventually, like, I was thinking of myself privately as a Nazi, I still, along all of these trajectories, I still bought into kind of the public relations version of white nationalism, of Nazism, whatever that is, where it's like, essentially we have humane goals, we have humane ends. To the extent that our politics seems to lead towards or imply conflict, that's just the nature of the world, Races are in conflict, and it's not we who cause that. We just have to stick up for our team. Don't hate the player, hate the game kind of thing.
Right. So what they would call almost more of the race realism sense of what it was rather than what it actually leads to, which is, this toxic, oppressive mess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just to tie a bow on that, like, I began meeting more and more people who there was no humanity there. It was just like, we just hate black people, period, the end. And I'm like, where's all this stuff? Like, going back to the concern I had about, like, foreign policy and how, American imperialism is a big problem. You guys don't care about that at all? I'm like, no, dead brown people. That's all we care about. That's awesome. Keep it going. We don't care. Like, man. So, there was that. And I kept having to, like, redraw my circles of who within white nationalism I trusted
Right.
And it eventually, like, the circle became so small that it just became unsustainable.
Understandable, yeah, because, like you said, a lot of the real, you know, kind of more thought out intellectual types definitely seem like they moved on after a certain point. And then the people who were left, you're looking at like Nathan D'Amigo, and all I know about him is what I read in the papers, but none of it's good.
Yeah. No. The formation of the National Justice Party actually was a big catalyst for me.
Ah.
Because my circle of people who I generally thought well of included some of the people who helped to start the National Justice Party, like Greg Conte.
Okay.
But to me, like, the lesson I got from Charlottesville, if you set aside the political content, whether you're in favor of the alt-right or not, the lesson I drew immediately after that was like, oh, we're amateurs. Like, we're clowns.
Okay.
We can't organize ourselves out of a paper bag. So what business do we have talking about all this world-conquering stuff? When we go into an event like Charlottesville, you don't even have an attorney on retainer. You have no preparation for all the fallout that's going to happen from this.
Mm-hmm.
You are a goofball. And that was my big lesson. And when I saw the National Justice Party start, I was like, these guys want to get the band back together again. They want to go through another cycle of telling the world that they're saving the white man, give us money, come out to these events. And I thought, I can't do this anymore. So the period prior to that, like, I was in like a questioning or kind of an in-between phase. But at that point, that's when I started like sending information to SPLC researchers.
Okay.
That's when I was like, okay, this, we have tried to square this circle for so long where we're saying, yeah, these white nationalist talking points are right, but this doesn't work. But what do we do? How do we make this work? And at that moment, I was like, why don't we just try it's all BS?
Yeah.
Why don't we just apply that rubric? That, you know, I've noticed, as much as I have made left-wing journalists out to be the enemy, I've noticed that rubric that they use to apply to all of this, that these people are just malfunctioning people, that this stuff is all just racism, that the PR stuff that I bought into is just that. It's just a glossy version of it to sell the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just try that theory for a while, that it is all bullshit? And immediately I was just like, ah, you know, it's like someone opened the window. Now I can breathe air. Now I don't have to worry about whether or not these people think I'm for real or not. You know, fuck them all.
Yeah.
And that's been much better. So.
Yeah. Because after a certain point, you look at it and you're just like, they didn't have a plan for what happened after that. And it became very obvious that they didn't have a plan when you saw how they all handled the fallout from Charlottesville. And it's interesting that you bring up the National Justice Party. I assume you're keeping track of how that ended up.
I'm enjoying it greatly.
Yeah, they really, I mean, who knew? You put a bunch of scummy people together and you have them start an organization of scummy people, and then it falls apart in the most public and embarrassing way possible. Shocked, you know, really, really shocked that those guys couldn't keep it together.
Yeah. what can I say? It's been a pleasure to watch, especially the stuff with Jazz Hands, because that guy, one of the worst of the bunch, in the sense that he did manage to profit big time off of the whole thing.
Oh yeah. You look at the numbers that came out recently, and that guy made hundreds of thousands of dollars on this, if not more.
Yeah. So a guy who is promoting the whole thing and pushing people towards creating chaos and death in other people's lives and theirs is just a guy who likes to, you know, ride boats and drive fancy cars and make sure he has zero skin in the game.
Yeah. So we've had a few formers on this podcast, and, you know, we're always glad to talk to people who've left it. Some of whom, like we mentioned Katie McHugh, for example, she paid a pretty heavy price for her involvement and walking away from it. What do you say to people who are skeptical about you and whether you made up for the damage your involvement caused?
I don't even try. I mean, if someone looks at me and says like, nope, and I've had this happen, not a lot. Almost alarmingly, not a lot, to be honest. But it has happened in a couple instances where someone learns about my past and, you know, my whatever statements I made afterwards, they aren't enough.
Right.
I don't judge those people at all. Because one of the things that really bothers me, I'll try to state this softly, it doesn't impress me when people leave And they make the whole thing about how they were bad then and they're good now, and they were victimized. Now, KWQ was victimized in a very real sense, so I'm not making light of her at all. But in other people's cases, they act like the victim. You know, to me, the only explanation that makes sense to me is that I have character flaws.
Right.
I have insecurities. I have things that I did not deal with and that I have to take responsibility for. And I don't just magically expect or give myself a free pass because I don't expect to be handed a trophy for having done a whole bunch of toxic and destructive shit and then all of a sudden just stopping it and recognizing that it was done. The reward is the reward itself. Like, I'm not engaged in it anymore. I'm not contributing to it anymore. I don't have to be stressing out and upsetting my family anymore. And that's all that I can expect from it. So it's great. I have had a lot of positive interactions and positive conversations. I think that, you know, obviously you can choose to be kind of inspired or impressed or heartened by the story that someone takes a turn and is able to say, oh, this is all very silly. But in terms of people who are skeptical, I don't have any special pitch to them. I think actually more skepticism is merited. There's an event that happens in the town that I live in here in Norway. It's essentially like if you imagine CPAC,
okay,
except it's not conservative, it's for everybody.
Okay.
It's respectable. Like, don't, you know, forget all the weird, like, bad associations with CPAC. It is for the entire country. It's a big political and civic gathering that happens every summer here. And there are roundtable discussions and speeches and workshops and talks and, you know, street stands for all the parties, for all the major organizations and groups in Norway. And there was a talk that was happening about de-radicalization and men. And I sent a message to one of the organizers maybe a week or two before. And introduced myself, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, oh, I'm sorry, we can't fit you on the panel. Like, it's already full.
Right.
And I thought, if you got a message from me and your first instinct was, let's put him on a panel, that is scary.
Right.
Because there are a lot of people who, it's very transparent, they don't really mean it. It's not an authentic conversion or change.
Yeah.
They're just seeking attention in a new form. They just don't like the consequences of what happened to them. You know, they don't like the consequences of what they caused. And so they try to put a different spin on it, but they haven't really changed their mentality at all. So sometimes I actually worry that people aren't more skeptical, but it is what it is. You know, for most of the people aren't nerdy and weird enough to get into this stuff to even figure out what it is.
Right, right.
The biggest message that I try to send is to right-wingers to say, I don't want to have anything to do with you at that level, at least at the level of politics. So please don't read about my backstory and think that we're going to connect and jive at some level. I'm totally done with that stuff.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the idea of putting people on a panel, because that happens like kind of all the time. With, it seems like there was a stretch for a while where guys like Matthew Heimbach were sort of halfway pretending to be reformed so they could put this stuff in front of a new audience.
Yeah.
Because you look at a guy like his politics, and it was really never about right wing or anything. This guy was definitely a third positionist, and he wanted a new audience. So one thing I kind of wanted to follow up on that you said earlier when we were talking was you mentioned sending information to somebody at the SPLC. Did you do a lot of that?
So what I did at that moment, I happened to know, I had met up with Greg Conte.
Okay.
The previous time I had visited the United States. And he and Charles Bousman tried to recruit me into whatever they were doing at that point. I think they were publishing Russia Insider.
Right.
They didn't have any specific thing that they wanted me to do, but I was like, no, I'm busy. My wife had gotten really disillusioned with me, with my involvement after I went through the whole cycle with Richard Spencer. So she had put a complete embargo on any notion of me doing any work for anybody.
Okay.
And I also just wasn't interested in whatever they were presenting. It was really unclear.
Hmm.
But I had learned from that they were operating out of Charles Bousman's property in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And so I could tell when I saw the videos of the National Justice Party, I could tell that that's where they were holding their gathering.
Right, right.
And so I created a dummy like Proton Mail account and sent that information to Michael Lettison Hayden.
Right.
I'm pretty sure he already had it. But afterwards, when I reconnected with him under my own name, he remembered that I had sent him that.
Okay.
But once I published my statement, then I started to have more journalists and researchers reaching out to me. And I've been an open book from that point. I mean, I'm not very helpful anymore because obviously I have no avenues of communication to right-wingers at this point.
Right.
But whatever information I do have from that time, I will 1,000% share with anyone who's interested.
Okay. So that's interesting. And I want to come back to Charles Bousman in a minute.
I know lots of fun and interesting people, Griff.
Yeah, Bousman, man. That guy was on the first thing smoking after January 6th. That's fascinating to me that that guy got the hell out of the country so fast.
Yeah.
And hasn't come back ever since then. And, you know, Michael Hayden, who you brought up, wrote some really interesting stuff about the connections between Bousman and Russia that are kind of surface level. It's hard to prove anything here, but oh boy, does it ever look kind of bad in light of how it all went down with that guy.
Yeah. Definitely.
Probably a lucky thing for you that you didn't end up getting recruited.
He was an eerie guy to talk with. You know, all of these people are unsettling for different reasons. Some of them because they look like they could commit a murder robbery at any moment. Some of them because they are so slick and well presenting that it's almost like, okay, your pocket square is never out of place. Like, what is going on here, man? You know, where is your life?
Yeah. Because, I mean, a lot of these guys, they really have an image, and it's this aesthetic that they've spent a lot of time working on and perfecting. And I think that's really appealing to a lot of people. They see that and they think, you know, I kind of want to be like that guy. I want that haircut. I want to have that look.
Yeah. I mean, to me, just going back to talking about I was an insecure kid. I mean, like, when I feel like I'm always just had such a need to be the smartest guy in the room, had such a need to, you know, impress people with my intellect and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And, you know, someone like Richard Spencer passes through and he's so well put together and, you know, has this kind of weird charisma about him, or like a figure like Jared Taylor, or Charles Bousman. Yeah. Some people do have a need, you know, to follow people like that.
Definitely. So where are you at right now politically?
Politically, I'll say, like, all of my sympathies lie in a, you know, left-wing direction. The debate that goes on in my head is always between, you know, just leftism and neoliberalism.
Right.
That's my bipolar energy right now. And I get people sometimes who are like, they try to say, listen, you can't completely reject the right. You can't think that right-wing politics has nothing. I mean, it can't be that like half the people are totally wrong. And my reaction is this: like, you have to be very careful about how I say this and make sure that people, particularly people who are arguing with me about this, make sure they hear what I'm saying. There can be certain policies that I can entertain that a right winger might not disagree with.
Right.
You know, there can be certain discrete policies, let's say on economics or whatever. I can't even think of any right now, but, you know, I'm not an expert in economics. So someone could argue with me and say, listen, the housing market really has to be organized this way as a Republican presenting the policy. Ah, okay. Maybe they're right. I don't know. But what I will never do is give energy to the right writ large as a political project, because that is not about policies. It's not about the merits or demerits of any particular policy. That is about generating fear and loathing, whipping up this energy, engaging in this culture war, race war toxicity to push a political program.
Yeah, agreed.
That is a not even once proposition. So if you come to me and say, I vote for this right-wing party for XYZ reasons, and, you know, you're bullshit, Evan, because you haven't even researched the issue.
Right.
That's all fine and well and good. I have no time or energy for the right. I've seen it, especially because so many of these people who want to argue about this stuff come to me, and the whole conceit and deceit on the right is our ideas are unfairly suppressed. We haven't been given a fair shake in the marketplace of ideas. You know, the journalists and the academics and the intelligentsia, that's all left-wing dominated. and we're the underdog, and no one has taken the time to really listen to what we have to say. Well, number one, that's crap.
Yeah.
Like, the right has orders of magnitude more of a market share in the marketplace of ideas than they merit and than they've earned. So let's put that to bed. It's been artificially propped up for decades.
Mm-hmm.
So let's set that aside. You can try that argument on someone else. You want to say that I haven't given enough of time and energy and mind space to the right? You want to say that to me?
Mm.
Please, please go pound sand.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure whoever, the people who come up to me and try to sell me on this stuff, again, these poor souls, it's like, buddy, no. I know the crap you're trying to sell me backwards and forwards. I mean, I've seen how the sausage is made, and so I just have no time for it.
It kind of reminds me of what Dakota Adams said a couple weeks ago when we had him on the podcast about how the straw for him that finally broke the camel's back was growing up in these constitutionalist, libertarian, prepper circles for years and being really, really super concerned about government overreach, super concerned about when the black helicopters come. And then 2020 happens, the demonstrations in Portland, Oregon with unmarked vans with Homeland Security snatching protesters off the street and throwing them in the back of vans, and all the prepper guys cheering, saying, yeah, that's just awesome. And he's like, wait a minute. We are against this. And they weren't. They were against it when it was them. And at some point, the mask just sort of falls and you realize, like, these guys only care when it's them.
I mean, the bigger sort of meta narrative that I've come around to, that I've come to understand, I mean, the whole thing, all the material that I was digesting from around 2000, 2002 or whatever, was just this constant complaint that the society is being dragged in the left-wing direction.
Right.
And each one of these people had a different utopia that they wanted to go back to. Thousands of years in the past. You talk to someone like Varg Vikernes, he wants to go back to before the advent of agriculture. That's the problem for him. So like you bring up the proper stuff. All of these people are adopting an essentially anti-social posture. They think they're smarter than the course of society over the last 50 or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 years. And it's such a dumb posture and take to have. The reason that it doesn't get rebutted as much as it should is because it is so dumb. And most serious people don't have the time and the energy to sit down with these people who won't listen anyways, who will set aside everything they hear anyways to explain, no, honey, this is progress. I'm not saying this is progress with a capital P. I'm presenting to you a political program progress. This is actually progress. Mm-hmm. Not having high rates of infant mortality is actually an improvement.
Yes.
You know, not living in a hunter-gatherer society is actually an improvement. Having women participating in society in a fuller way, having people who aren't just white, you know, in your clubs,
This is a good thing.
This is a good thing. Okay. So I eventually figured out, okay, this really is simple. I'm just going to take the contra. These guys are always like, oh, you know,
right?
The government, the this and the that, and society is being dragged. No, civilization is a left-wing phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, becoming more generally more peaceful, generally more cooperative over time. It's essentially left-wing, the leftist proposition, and it's winning because it should win over time. So that's what it is. So the people that I deal with more, I get very few, I have very little contact, except online, they come at me sometimes, but very, very little contact with actual white nationalists. The people I have more contact with now are just kind of like people who are digesting Jordan Peterson or Andrew Tate or, you know, stuff at that level.
Right, right.
So, you know, they're the stuff that they claim to be stressed out about, that our kids are being made trans, or feminism has thrown, you know, marriage and dating into this crisis that makes life impossible, that makes life unlivable. I'm just like, okay, really?
Yeah.
Where? Like, show me. In your personal life, show me the chaos that has been created.
And they generally can't.
They can't.
So, kind of switching gears for a second, let's talk about Richard Spencer. Richard, at one point, may have been the most famous white nationalist alive. But in the past few years, he's really been trying to distance himself from white nationalism. He went as far as to endorse Joe Biden in 2020. He's endorsed him again in 2024. And one thing I think I and a lot of other people have noticed, however, is that there's no disavowal or apology for any of his past activities.
Right.
You knew this guy pretty well at one point. Do you think he's actually changed any of his views, or is this the same guy?
You know, I will, I'll give you the short version, and then I'll give you as much of the longer version as you can tolerate. The short version is Richard is not a completely stupid person. You can go and read what he has to say and try to suss out and like interrogate his actual views and what he's sorry for and what he's not sorry for. And to what extent is he a racist and what kind of racist is he? And what is his posture towards the Democratic Party? I mean, you can do all that. And I will tell you that the juice is not worth the squeeze.
Yeah.
The juice is not worth the squeeze in the sense that that like idiom doesn't even remotely do it justice. They have to create another idiom to explain how little it is worth the effort to try and figure this out. I'll try and pick out the points where I can like defend, if that makes sense. Like the support for Biden is genuine.
Oh, I assumed it was.
Yeah. It's not part of a bit.
No, I mean, there's a real sentiment and people didn't really get that in 2020 amongst a lot of those guys that Trump was not particularly good for the white man.
Right.
And I know that sounds insane to hear, like some people would think that that sounds crazy, but I'm sitting here listening to their conversations. I'm reading what they're saying to each other on Telegram. And it's like, no, they actually thought Biden was better for white people.
Yeah.
Spoiler. True. Biden's better for all people.
Right. He's better for all people, including white people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the right is selling white people with this moral and existential panic.
Right.
And they're getting nothing in return. I mean, they're just, you're becoming more of the villain. You're becoming more alienated from society. Materially, you're not going to get anything. You can walk down that road and try to explain what it is a Trump voter is actually going to get out of this.
You can't.
They're bringing all of us down together. They're driving all of us into a ditch, but leaving that aside. Yeah. So like, yeah, he's like in that analysis, as far as it goes, like he's correct. And he has a coherent like reason for supporting Biden.
Mm-hmm.
But he is, I guess we can start with him, with Richard himself. He is a deeply flawed and narcissistic person. I mean, if I can go back to like my background and say like, yeah, it's insecurity that leads people towards the alt-right. You have to have a kind of antisocial mentality or inclination to get into this stuff. But then also noting, like, I really didn't have anything to complain about in my life. I was just a weak person who couldn't handle the ordinary pressures of life. Let's look at Richard Spencer. This guy is materially fantastically well off. If he just chose to be a normal person, he could have a great life.
Right.
If he could find a way just not to be a creep at the end of the day and just kind of be a chaos agent in his own family life, you know, it could all work out and be good. But he just can't help himself. And there's a wire that is crossed in there somewhere. And so, you know, you can go look at his analysis and discussions and try and figure out what it is he's trying to say. And on the surface, there's like, you can look and take a pass and say, oh, there's a lot here. There really isn't. It all has to be kind of weird at the end of the day. So like, is he anti-Semitic? Maybe not in the crude sense that you'll get from a lot of anti-Semites, but he's like, every version of everything, he has to create his own kind of bespoke,
right,
like weird, cool, smart version of it.
Because it's about him fundamentally.
Yeah. So the racism and the anti-Semitism, like all of that stuff is still there. It's just Richard's cooler version of it so that he can look down on all of the other racists and anti-Semites.
Right. So like racism, but hipster.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah, basically. And I could go into more detail about that, but I mean, it's just not worth it.
No, I mean, I absolutely, that pretty much sums it up. Like, because, you know, we've been reading the guy's stuff for a number of years, you get the idea that it really is all about him and how people relate to him and how He really fancies himself as this intellectual.
Yeah.
And people think he's the devil on some level, but he's not. He's just kind of a rich kid who is in the right place at the right time and is known for getting punched as much as he's known for anything.
Yeah. That's a pretty perfect read of it. You can go and you can try to get excited about how he does, like, at some level, he does have the correct position on Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just let him be in his corner and have the correct position on Ukraine and go about our business. It's not really worth engaging.
Right. Even a lot of the younger folks seem to think he's not worth listening to anymore. The Nick Fuentes crowd, they're not huge fans of this guy at all.
No.
And really, his shelf life is over at this point. He's going to get what he's going to get, but he's definitely not outside of the 2017 and Charlottesville, you know, hangover. He's not going to get any mention in anything that's going on now.
And that's fine. I mean, I don't wish ill upon anyone personally. I hope everyone sorts themselves out and gets away from this stuff. And I had a moment where I'm like, is he getting there? You know, he had that interview with, I forget her name.
Was it CNN?
Yeah, it was like a CNN advice interview and he was crying.
Right.
Okay, I know. I mean, I can tell stories about how just comically narcissistic this person is. But I thought, is he starting to get there? And that, I had his number blocked for like a year or two at that point, but I unblocked it, assuming that he probably had changed his number by that point. But at that moment, I sent him a message just saying, hey, like, hope you're good. And didn't get a response. And then it went like another week. And I'm looking at the stuff he's putting out there and it's like, nope, he's crying because it was a rough time for him.
Right.
Is why he's crying. And that's all that it's all it's ever going to be. So
it's all about how it affects Richard Spencer.
Yeah.
Right. So in an article entitled "The Charlottesville Rally Was Apparently Planned at a Trump International Hotel," it was Colin Kalmbacher, and it was dated August 26, 2017. It is claimed that you and your group, among others, were frequent guests at the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., with you quoted specifically on Twitter saying that it was, quote, the place to be.
Yeah.
Why did you feel that way?
Yeah. this is one of those rare moments when I actually have to, like, kind of defend myself at the time, only in the sense that that whole thing was blown out of proportion. I'll give you the facts. I was never a guest at the Trump Hotel. As far as I know, Richard was never a guest, except in the sense that they had a bar in the lobby and we would go there. Okay. So there was never any, like, we're being invited there by someone in the Trump campaign or anything like that.
So you guys weren't going there to hang out with the money guys and
no. And so I can tell you where that whole story arose from. So we went, Stephen Miller had just given a speech. This was, he had given remarks to the press. He had held a press conference and he had said some stuff that was like right off the pages of VDare. You know, the kind of stuff that, like, if you're a VDare reader and they're having a discussion of immigration on the radio or on NPR or something, you're punching the steering wheel. Like, why won't they say this? Why won't they say that? Well, Stephen Miller said some of those things.
Right.
And we were like, yeah, this is awesome. So a couple of days later, we head down to Trump Hotel because that was just the thing. You know, Richard liked to scope out women there. And it was just a place to go. And we had, it was me and Greg Conte and Richard and another really young kid. And we were just hanging out just at the bar. And then Stephen Miller walked in with Nigel Farage.
Okay.
And we were all so pumped. And that's when I said this tweet. I'm like, here's Stephen Miller and Nigel Farage. Everyone's down here. This is the place to be. And within like an hour or two, a journalist from the New York Times reached out to me and was like, can we talk about this? And so this is my big mistake. So I, at first I was like, yeah, I might talk to her. And I was talking with Richard, like, should I talk to this journalist? What should I do? And at first he was like, yeah, maybe. And then he was like, nah, I don't do it. So I replied to her. I was like, hey, we're busy planning this rally. Okay, so what I meant by that was, like, we're busy planning, like, I have to figure out how to get there, who am I riding with.
Right.
You know, we're planning it from that perspective. And I'm not trying to, like, absolve myself of responsibility for Charlottesville. I'm just saying, like, I was not involved in the logistics of Charlottesville. The stuff that I was busy with at the time, like, Richard had managed to fail to file the paperwork to maintain the tax-exempt status of the National Policy Institute. And he, one of the reasons he brought someone like me on was because he has no time for actual responsibility and paperwork and filing stuff. So he wanted me to do that stuff.
Okay.
So I was busy doing that. I didn't have time for the logistics of Charlottesville. That was Greg Conte's thing. That was Eli Mosley, Elliot Klein's thing. So I wasn't planning a rally, but regardless, that's those are the words that I ended up sending to this journalist. So the next thing, they're running a story about how we're planning the rally at the hotel, you know, together with Stephen Miller and Nigel Farage and all these people. And none of that is remotely true. But there was this like weird social energy around the Trump Hotel that we were like insinuating ourselves into.
Right.
But we were never brought into any like kind of inner circle activity there.
So what you're saying is it was kind of a shit post that sort of got out of hand?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So what was the relationship like with the more mainstream elements of the GOP and some of the people who might have been referred to as alt-light during your time with the NPI?
Yeah. I mean, Richard was the contact point of all that. Like, he was the person with the social capital, the person that people knew. That definitely wasn't me. So he was the one who was like interfacing, you know, back channel for the most part with a lot of these people. And there's the stuff about Jack Posobiec that's out there. And there were probably other people. I think for the most part, these contacts and connections have been explored. And they were a thing and they were relevant when, as you have pointed out, like Richard was the thing and he had right. energy and like, you know, he had something going. And it's, you know, no longer is relevant today. And kind of quickly lost its relevance once Charlottesville happened.
Right.
So that's about what I know and can say about it, which is to say I don't really know anything more than the average person who, or the person who is like reading or studying this stuff for the information that they can find
right
out on the internet. It's just that I was like, you know, if he was meeting up with somebody, like I remember having dinner with, you know, Richard and Charles Johnson,
okay,
or Chuck Johnson, the little redheaded Muppet.
Mm-hmm. He's a fan. He loves this podcast.
Yeah, big fan. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, I bet. Yeah, so I would just kind of be a fly on the wall for conversations like that, but nothing more.
Right. Yeah, that's another one of those guys that he's doing what he's doing and seems yeah. like, the more you dive into that rabbit hole, the crazier it gets. And another, is there really anything there? There is his juice really worth the yeah. squeeze? That's a good way right. to put it. So if you could have a conversation, if you could go back and have a conversation with your younger pre-white nationalist self about the choices that guy was about to make, what would you say?
I've wondered about this and also just about other things having to do with life. And I wonder if I could go back with, you know, a perfect evidence and an explanation for everything that was going to happen, would I still even listen to myself? I mean, I think the stubbornness and just the hormonal stupidity of teenagers and young adults, it's a force of its own, and I'm not right. sure that I would listen to myself. But the thing that I would try to get across most strongly is kind of what I talked about earlier, which is, please point to me where this stuff is happening in your own life.
Yeah.
Like, where is the crisis that feminism has created? Where is this like surging crime or these waves of non-whites that are just like taking over everything? What's the thing? Like, what is it that you're upset about? Please be specific. And please, please notice when you are buying into rhetoric that has nothing specific. It's just kind of hyperventilation. I mean, I think maybe even more important to that, I would just kind of be a friend and mentor to myself.
Right.
Because I think that is what young people need, even if they don't always say it directly. Just having someone who's looking out for them, giving them pointers, giving them guidance. You know, there are probably critical points, especially when I was getting into this kind of weird stuff. It's so its own like niche that it's hard for other people to relate or even to know what to say unless right. they have dug into it themselves. So now that I have, I would have been equipped to say, hey, this is just some weird online stuff that you're on, man.
Right.
Like, focus your energy elsewhere and you'll be a lot happier.
This isn't the real world. Go out and look at the real world. It looks nothing like what you're hearing here.
No.
So what are you doing with yourself these days? Do you have any projects going, or are you kind of just a private citizen these days?
Yeah, just a private citizen. Basically, I do podcasts and stuff like this once in a while.
Right.
But just being a family guy, I have two daughters.
Nice.
Studying and working and training jiu-jitsu, playing a little ice hockey.
Nice.
Here and there. So just trying to keep everything on a level.
Nice. Okay. Well, hey, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today, Evan. I really appreciate it. I've learned a lot. This has been a fascinating conversation.
Yeah.
You have a great rest of your day. Appreciate your time.
Cool. Thanks, Riff. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the Did Nothing Wrong podcast. If you want to hear more, you can find us on the web at didnothingwrongpod.com. Please make sure you subscribe to get our content straight into your inbox. You can also follow us on Twitter at GrizzaBJJ, GrzaBJJ, as well as DNWPod. We're extremely grateful for paid subscriptions and donations that allow us to keep doing this important work. Thanks, and remember, everyone mentioned did nothing wrong.